Hey folks, Sean Andrich here. Couple quick notes before we start the show. First, a brief technical one. Our guest this week is John Deweese, also known as JD Zappa on the DWJ forums. Unfortunately, his local track didn't pan out, so we're using a backup. So it's still very listenable and should be fine. It's just not quite up to our usual quality. So apologies for that. And in a more somber note, back in May, longtime Gamers with Jobs member Dr. Awkward, also known as Tim Stanton, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. So a GoFundMe page was created and money was raised to help Tim and his family financially while they underwent aggressive treatment for the cancer. Unfortunately, the prognosis isn't looking very good at this point. Doctors only give him a few more weeks and his body is beginning to shut down. So barring a miracle, the odds are Tim is going to be leaving behind a daughter, 2 6-year-old boys, and of course his wife Missy. We can't do much to change his prognosis, but Tim has been with Gamers with Jobs pretty much from the beginning, and he's been a longtime supporter of the site. And if you've ever played games for the community, there's a good chance you've had the pleasure of playing with him. He's a really good dude, and this sucks. So I'll be putting a link in the show notes where you can go and contribute money to the GoFundMe page to help his family as they go through this difficult transition. And yeah. It's been a real honor to have Tim as part of the community. On with the show. This is the Gamers with Jobs conference call for October 25th, 2017. I'm your host, Sean Andrich, and joining me here this week, first up, we have Carla Andrich.
Hello.
My wife. We also have Amanda Knowlton.
Hi.
Maybe more importantly, Carla Andrich, our game master for the next GWJ RPG series.
Right, yes.
Yes, yes, which we haven't even revealed the name yet.
Where's
yes,
my cape and hat?
And Amanda is one of our players, so pretty exciting stuff. And
we're
finally,
gonna talk about that now, huh?
Well, just
that
that it exists. It's all we're talking about right now. Still have to get orbital decay. And speaking of exciting, we have a Gamers Jobs community member on the show this week. We have John Deweese, also known as JD Zappa, in the forums. Welcome.
Hello.
Very good to have you on. John is one of our very generous Patreon contributors, and the project you brought to us, which we really loved, was this Gamers with Hope article series. So people could write articles, editorials about talking about gaming in a positive direction, where it's really helped you in your life, where it's brought you hope, maybe in dark times and things like that. So I've written some. Greg Decker wrote that great piece called Building Bridges for it. And we're hoping to get some more writers, actually. So our topic this week is going to be Gamers with Hope. And of course, we have your emails. But first, we're going to talk about video games you've been playing. And John, since you're a special guest, how about you start? What have you been playing lately?
Okay. So I guess let me start off. My son and I just got back from GE2 in Seattle. So it's this virtual reality / laser tag / they had drone racing. So I think a number of, I saw Microsoft, HTC Vive, just a number of the big companies around Seattle put it on at the at event center in downtown Seattle. It was a lot of fun. So I got a chance to play around with the Vive, try a bunch of the like mini games. There are a couple of like there's one hilarious VR game called Babyline Royale that I don't know. Do you want me to kind of go into that a little bit more?
Absolutely, 100% for sure. Is this your first time actually trying VR? Have you tried it before?
I tried some of it actually last PAX, so I played around with the PlayStation, which was pretty cool, but this was my first time doing the HTC Vive, which was really neat. So being actually able to move around the entire time, you know, do like Fruit Ninja and you know, 3D was really cool, where you're spinning around, you know, trying to cut the fruit. So Babylon is actually, it's for the Oculus, and the idea behind it is in the future, humans have created like these designer babies, and they're supposed to live forever. The problem is, so they mature, but they are stuck in their 2-year-old bodies. So they to entertain themselves, they have these battles against each other in these robot cars they call chariots. And so you've got like babies that are dressed like Prince, and one of them looks like Wolverine, one of them looks like Mariah Carey, and so you're just running around against the other guy trying to fight with them in your souped up like car robot. And when you knock them out, then they fall out and they start crying, and then it starts playing like Superstar, you know, and it's just like hilarious funk, you know. It is a very cute game. It's not out yet. I think it's coming out first quarter 2018, but it was hilarious. So
sorry, what is it called again?
I want to say it's called Babylon. So it's like Bebylon Royale.
Sorry, it is, and I thought you were pronouncing it wrong, and I was just gonna wait to politely chime in with the correct pronunciation. So I'm so glad you clarified that, because yeah, it's a play on Babylon.
Yeah.
So yeah, the pronunciation that tracks there.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
that's just wild. So okay, so what else did you see while you're there?
So there was let me just double check it. Sprint Vector was fun. So it's a newer one for the Vive, and it's basically you're doing like a race, and you're pulling yourself forward with the sticks, and it's almost like cross country. So you're running along with the sticks, and you have to kind of like jump up and down and pull yourself up walls. So that was really cool. And then I would say watching my son do Job Simulator was hilarious, where he's purposely picking up all the moldy donuts and, you know, throwing up the whole time, and just like, awesome. You know, chucking everything, knocking things over. It's funny to watch a 9-year-old, you know, wreck an office. So,
9 years old. So you're kind of getting him ready to get a job then. It's like good prep. Yeah. For his first terrible job in the workforce. That's excellent. And so you mentioned there was also drones there and stuff too. So it wasn't just video games.
Right. I think that was one of the things that was really cool. So they had a number of, you know, some of the local drone pros were out there doing, you know, they're doing a finals, like Seattle finals. So they set up a whole racing field that you could watch the heats going on. We weren't, you know, able to stay for the finals tonight, which were around 6:37, but it was really neat. It was the first time I've seen drone racing. And they also had a laser tag field set up with where the weaponry looked like, you know, like a real M16, a real MP5, and it kind of felt heavier like a gun, but it's a laser tag thing. And so they loaded up, and you have a certain number of shots, and that was pretty cool. So sounds probably a little more sinister than it actually was. It was, you know, the whole families were running around, you know, on the course. It was a lot of fun.
I don't know. I've played laser tag, and I, like 11-year-olds in laser tags are vicious little buggers, to say the least. And if they can run up ramps and stuff without exhausting their quads in 5 minutes, like I do, yeah, that's awesome. So that's the G2 gaming. I hadn't actually heard about this one before, but there's like dodgeball and all kinds of stuff there. That's wild. That's super cool. That's very nice.
You said that was down in Seattle, right? So
yeah, so the Seattle, it's CenturyLink Event Center, so it's a little bit further south of downtown. So yeah, if anyone who's in, you know, even from Vancouver, Portland, I'd highly recommend coming to check it out next year. So
nice, sure. Yeah, two day tickets, general admission $50.
Oh, yes,
oh, that's
general
not
admission
bad.
For a
no,
day.
No, we should do that.
Bucks.
We should do that next year.
Yeah, it's pretty neat, actually. Drones are cool, too. So other than that, in terms of video games and stuff, John, I think you'd mentioned you've been playing Total Warhammer 2.
Yes, I have. So
Total War Warhammer 2. I just call it Total Warhammer. I've been playing it as well, so I'm interested in your thoughts.
Okay, yeah, same back at you. So this is the standalone expansion to the first one that I think came out last year. And for me, it's scratching that itch between a game where it's turn-based, you do all your base building and all your recruitment in turn-based, and then when you actually fight a battle, it's in real time where you're moving around, you know, units with hundreds of troops. It kind of feels like a real battle if real battle involved, like, you know, flying elves and and dark elves and you know, chittering rat men. But so it's the fantasy version of the Total War series, which has been going for, I guess, like 15, 20 years, and they've done a lot of like historical stuff. So in the past they've done you know, Shogun, they've done Rome, Total War, so yeah, and then they've taken all this into fantasy. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm playing the Skaven, which are these like mutant ratmen, and their giant weapon of choice is a giant hamster wheel called the Doom Wheel, and just roll it into the enemy lines, and then you just shoot lasers everywhere. And I think one of the things I really love about the Skaven is forever I've had a problem with friendly fire my own guy. So like when I was playing other Total War series set in Napoleonic times, I would like kill half my own guys because I would be, you know, dropping artillery on them or shooting them by accident. Well, that's like highly encouraged with the Skaven. You put out your cheap guys, you run them in, and then you just like start firebombing everybody, and it works out nicely. So that's actually, you know, solved a major tactical problem of mine for years now. So,
and the Skaven, from my understanding, they kind of play like the barbarian nations in Rome 2 Total War, in that they need to keep moving. Like you don't like go take over a city and occupy it and stuff like that. The Skaven like really need to keep plundering and moving on.
Well, so it's actually a little weird in that they can take over cities, but you have this food mechanic. So you can start building your cities as much as you want, but you got to keep moving and taking food and capturing other people to eat them. So it's in that way you can have multiple cities, but the bigger you grow, the harder it is to support everybody. And the more, you have this, like Skaven contagion, that's not the right word, but it's basically you're spreading, you know, you're kind of disease everywhere, and it affects you too. So eventually you got to keep moving to new areas, or else, you know, your own cities are going to start to fall apart, and you're going to have constant warfare with your underlings. So there's a lot of, you know, people are scamming beneath you, and they're gonna like revolt against you eventually, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that. But you know, it kind of brings a fun flavor into it when you're waiting who's going to betray you next. So
and it's so typically Warhammer, because tonally the Skaven are so radically different in tone than like the High Elves.
Correct.
I decided to play the High Elf campaign because like I play Total Warhammer, I've played a lot of the Total War games, but I always feel like I've forgotten half of how these things work every time. So I decided I'll just play with the vanilla High Elves, and they're just so self-serious. Like they're so serious compared to the Skaven, which are basically comedy relief in a lot of ways. And I've been really digging it too. One of the things I've liked a lot, because Rome 2 was such a bad launch at the time, and the Warhammer series, they did a lot of things right at like beyond just like the humor and the different fantasy units and the feeling of that being really fresh, things like turns running quickly. When I hit end turn, it just cycles through like 30 or 40 factions so fast, and I can go again. Right. And like, it does a lot. They seem to bring in a lot of enhancements and a lot of, it just seems to be programmed better. I don't know a better way to put that. It's telling to me that you kind of called it a standalone expansion, even though it is actually being sold and marketed as a full-on sequel. I actually agree. It does feel like a really big standalone expansion rather than a completely new game. I played maybe 20, 30 hours of Total War Warhammer, the original. This doesn't feel like a huge leap from that to this. This feels actually pretty incremental.
And that's my experience as well. They've changed a number of things enough that they've improved the end game, because you can still lose the end game even if you've expanded, you're rolling. The whole idea is that you have these rituals you have to perform. And so you can have an enemy on the other side of the board that you haven't fought much, and if they're, you know, if they're performing their rituals faster than you are, then they can go ahead and win. And I'm actually in that situation in my Skaven campaign where the high elves are on their nice little island, and I can't get to them yet. And so they're in the race to unlock their magic, whereas I'm trying to, I think it's to summon the Great Horned Rat, which is our like evil demonic god. So it's
hell yeah.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's, I feel like, it's probably going to be down to the wire, and that's a nice feeling versus at a certain point in a lot of these games, you've already won.
It's an eight hour mop up deal. Cause in Warhammer 2, there's this big magical, at least in the elf campaign, I don't know if it's different for the Skaven, but there's that big magical vortex in the middle of this island, which is basically a big circle. So it's a really interesting kind of terrain to need to fight. Because you're not just dealing with this big Pangea-like blob of, you're not just in Italy or you're not in Germany. Like, you're actually in a pretty unique space that you need to work with. There's settlements that are large walls that cut off one areas and things like that. So controlling those can be really beneficial. And I'm early in. But it just seems like it's got its teeth in me big time. And they've also got DLC. It's either out or it's coming out that's actually going to combine all the Total War Warhammer stuff and the Total War Warhammer 2 stuff and expanding the map to cover everything, which is bananas. That's a really big game at that point.
Something like 150 factions, something crazy.
Yeah.
And I think it's coming this week, actually. I think it's coming like the 26th, or it might be next week. It's coming really soon. So
And we'll see. As far as it's coming, we'll see if it actually works. I just kind of wonder if the engine's going to collapse under its own weight trying to...
Right.
When I hit end turn, do I need to go make a sandwich? Like, these are questions I need answered. but I'm definitely interested to see how it goes. So that's Total War Warhammer 2. You can get that on Steam. It's a full price game, $60. But so far, I'd say it's good. And if it's been a long time since you've played a Total War game, I think these are pretty good ones to get into. In a lot of ways, one of the reasons they're really successful is they've streamlined. There's still a lot of systems, a lot of interface stuff, but they do a good job of actually introducing all these different elements as they become relevant. And it does actually feel fairly streamlined. I think it's a good way to enter into the series if you've never played a Total War game or if it's been since the original Rome that you tried one. It's worth jumping in. I think it's actually pretty great. Carla, I want to jump over to you. You haven't exactly been playing a game per se, but I did recruit you to play Until Dawn on the PS4 with me because Halloween's coming.
Yeah, my usual backup position that for Sean playing horror games. He really needs somebody to be there in the room with him.
I can't believe this is how you start. This is it right here. Like, it's true though. Like, I was playing. Although I will say, Until Dawn is not a particularly
scary game
at all. This is more of a game. In fact, I spend a lot of time kind of cheering for all these. I guess we could call them millennials.
Truly terrible people to die.
Yes.
Like, it got to the point where we're like, which of these choices is most likely to lead to this person's gruesome demise?
Yeah. And just to give a quick overview, Until Dawn, I believe it's a PS4 exclusive, and it is it's told in sort of an episodic format. At points in the game, it'll do a previously on Until Dawn, even though there's no real clear separation between each episode. It seems to be kind of random when they cut in and out like that. But you are playing a bunch of... Are they actually teens or are they in their early...
Yeah, they're teenagers. No, they're still teenagers in the second... There's a first sort of prequel which takes place... I think it's supposed to be like 2014, and then the next is 2015, and they're like seniors at that point, but they are supposed to be teenagers who are still going to high school and living at home.
So kind of a 90210 deal, because all of the actors are in their mid to late 20s at least.
Yeah, and they didn't do a whole lot to make them look younger. Like, all the characters are very closely based on the characters' actual faces. Like, they did a lot of motion capture, like sort of emotional kind of, dots on the face, kind of actual acting on the parts of the actors. And a lot of them are recognizable from TV and stuff.
Like there's the... Hayden. I've got the list here. Hayden Panettiere. Yeah. She plays Samantha. She is, well, she's the cheerleader from Heroes.
Yeah.
Remember when she played a teen when that show Heroes that was
like 10
how
years
long ago
or
was that?
Long ago? Yeah.
And there's also the guy from Mr. Robot, I believe. The lead from that show is actually on this.
Rami Malek. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Brett Dalton from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. also plays a teenager.
Yes.
In this game.
Is that intentional? Like, when was that a play on how a lot of shows have been and were in the past when this was, like, a huge genre?
I honestly think there is an element to that. They really do... They lean in hard enough on the cheese, like, the B-movie kind of... that kind of era of horror, like Scream and things like that. Like, they do lean on that pretty hard. It has to be intentional on some level.
Yeah. The writing is actually pretty solid for what it is. Unfortunately, what it is a play on horror movie tropes where all the dudes are unrelenting horn dogs and all the girls fall into two different categories, which is like one plucky, you know, non-horny, and then really slutty, bitchy, like let's have lots of sex kind of paradigm.
Right,
and
because they're the ones
like,
who have to die, basically.
Yeah,
there's
so much rapey kind of conversations between the guys. I was just like, ugh, how quickly can you kill these people, basically?
I know. Which is kind of refreshing when you're playing a quote-unquote like horror game, because you're just like, I want all of you to die on some level. So this is going to be fun. And the actual gameplay, it's that sort of, you're just moving, it's like Life is Strange or Resident Evil or something like that. It's not really an action game. You're moving at your character throughout the environments, throughout this big mansion, house, on a ski hill, basically. And
large portions of it are cinematics that happen without your input one way or another.
Yeah. There's quick time events, which are not like, generally speaking, to their credit, like they make a big play for you. Say this and it's going to have this butterfly effect on the rest of the story, or you do this or you do that. And I will say, like, I failed some quick time events. In fact, I didn't fail many, but when I did, heads rolled because I did not press a button or kept the, sometimes they'll actually do a thing where you need to keep the DualShock controller really steady, like, you know, like don't move, don't breathe, and it's really sensitive. So I'm like not moving, and I jerk it just slightly tilt, and he steps on a twig or something. And then something really bad happens, and that character's dead. So there is actually a way to play Until Dawn where everybody survives, but you'd have to basically be a quick time master to pull it off. And so you're making the occasional dialogue choice. It's usually binary kind of choices that you make with not necessarily a lot of context. And the challenge, it's funny because we were kind of both rolling our eyes a lot. I will say, like, it looks, there's Uncanny Valley stuff. They do a lot of close-ups on faces that doesn't always pay off, but generally speaking, it looks good. And they jump perspectives a lot. Like, you're moving from character to character. It's a neat way to tell a story when there's a cast of like eight. Basically.
And also necessary because, like, I think depending on the choices you make, everybody in the game can die. Like, everybody is up for grabs.
Yeah, for sure. So everybody can die, and you've got, and they'll tell you when you've made a choice that's going to have some impact on the rest of the story. Like, not tell you what it's going to be. There's also these totems you can pick up, and they're supposed to give you some glimpse or some insight into what may happen in the future. Like, if you pick up a death totem, the characters never react to that. It's pure player knowledge thing, but it'll actually jump you into the future a bit. You'll see like a little snippet of a death that could happen in the future, and you might have a sense environmentally where it is, but there's no indication or idea of what you could do to avoid it, right? Like, there's nothing. It's just like they layered a lot of stuff and a lot of ideas in. One of the things with horror games, though, that I think all horror games have to contend with is, how do we make a horror game that's going to maintain tension for 8 hours? Right, because a horror movie, you're in and out in an hour and a half, 2 hours, generally speaking, and you're done. And I thought Until Dawn actually tackled this in a fairly interesting way.
I mean, it has ups and downs, right? It's not like you can't tell a classic story in the context of a video game because there's the rising tension, you know, the three act sort of setup that you need to really make a story run like a fire engine. And you really can't do that in a game because you're relying on the character to do a lot of things. And in fact, a lot of times there would be a choice to be made and you could just set down the controller and walk away, which pretty much kills the kind of tension that they're looking for. Occasionally those choices were timed, but not always. And so, like, we got to the point where things were kind of like, all right, okay. Yeah, he's getting cut in half. Can we please get on to the next point, you know? Rather than that having any kind of tension or meaning or us caring at all one way or another.
And yet, it was like rolling on 10 p.m. I'm like, all right, I think we'll stop the next, like, previously on or something, because we should probably stop. And then we played another hour. So there is something compelling us to keep going. And we are going to finish this game. I think we're pretty close to the end.
Yeah.
I do want to see how it ends, because there's twists, there's turns, it's one thing, then it's another thing. And there's enough there that I got this free through PlayStation Plus. It was one of the free games a few months ago. So I'm glad I didn't pay for it, but I'm also glad that I'm playing it. Like, it's hokey, but I actually do dig it. I think it's fun. I can be fun in a party setting too.
Yeah. Warning for some pretty tropey Native American stereotypical bullshit.
Oh, it's really bad, man. Yeah. Like, it's really bad. It's again, that is a very tropey thing, but it's, ugh. I don't like it.
Can we just leave that behind?
Like, please. 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 So that's Until Dawn. It's a PS4 exclusive. It's been out for a couple of years now, I think, so it's probably pretty cheap and not a bad way to spend a Halloween. I would say it is a probably 8-hour-ish game to finish, so you may not be able to do it in one night, but you know what? You can probably get it cheap. It's dumb, and it's kind of... I'm reluctant to say it's fun, but again, we're still playing it. We're gonna finish it.
So you gotta
give it credit. It's got us. It's got us. Amanda, have you been playing anything?
Yeah. So I feel like I'm a champion for mobile games at this point. I feel like not enough people are talking about them and playing them because there's some really weird, interesting stuff out there, and the one that I wanted to talk about this week is called I Became a Dog. It's by a group called We Like Games. I think it's on both Android and iOS. And it has an amazing amount of depth, as well as just... It gets dark, and I'm not going to talk too much about the story or any of the abilities or anything that you have, because it's kind of... It would be spoilery. But one thing I do want to mention is that of the two abilities that you get on the screen, there's a little timer, and then underneath the timers are little dots. What those little dots are is even if the timer is rebuilding, you can still use those abilities. Those dots are just stored ability. So you can actually acquire skills and such to help further the story relatively quickly if you notice this right away. The only other thing is if you're somebody who tends to skip through dialogue sometimes, like hesitate, like don't do that, read all of the dialogue, because of how the story progresses, you can't go back to these NPCs and reread their dialogue parts that they've already given you. So there are some hints, there's some facts. There's a really deep community already of people who have tried to find different alts. So there's 5 different endings, like how to get to those 5 different endings. And it reminds me a lot of a LucasArts game or even one of the old Sierra games where it's like, get this object, then do this, and then do this, and then find this other thing, and then talk to this person, and then collect these things. And so it's got a lot to it, but it's not, I mean, it's funny, it's silly, but it's also, the themes are somewhat dark. And so I've done 2 of the 5 endings now, and I did the first 2. So the first one's the worst, and then they progressively get better. So the last and 5th and final ending is the quote unquote good ending, and it's the hardest to do. The task list is so long, I glanced at it. I don't know how you would find this on your own, but apparently people can do it. So, yeah, it's called I Became a Dog. It's all pixel art. It's lovely and disturbing and interesting. I definitely recommend it.
Nice.
But, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. John, let's jump back over to you. Another thing you mentioned you were playing, Guild Wars 2 has been a game that's been around for quite a while and pretty evergreen. It still seems to have a lot of community support for it. You mentioned you've been playing the more recent expansion.
Yeah, so because I've been pretty busy, we're actually just put our house on sale. It's been Warhammer and a little bit of Guild Wars 2, but they've done some really interesting thing with the new expansion. One of the coolest things, if you played the original game, they've gone back to an area that they had in Guild Wars 1 called Alona, and it's a it's basically a North African, Middle Eastern setting, and from everything I've heard of Until Dawn, it's like the opposite of that. They did a lot of work with a lot of, you know, cultural experts to get it really right, and so it's this very cool setting of, like, you know, like I said, Egypt, North Africa, but the place feels very much alive. So your characters are going there to basically stop the human god Balthazar from blowing up the world. And I don't want to go too much into it because I know it's a MMO, but it feels very easy for you to just jump right back into. There's a lot of cool stuff. If you've played before, if you're new, it's very easy to get into. And I think the thing I like the most is they have these interesting mounts. So in a lot of other games, you know, your horse works pretty much like your giant hippogriff that you spent $50 to Blizzard on. In Guild Wars 2, like the Raptor will jump up and it'll, like, you know, hit people in the face with its tail, or you have this giant jumping jackalope mount that'll jump up like way high, and so you basically use your different mounts to get to different areas, and I think that's really cool. And each mount has a lot of personality, so that's been a lot of fun with it. Nice. And the writing, and I'll say this probably, you know, I'll like shots fired here, but the writing I feel is better than Mass Effect Andromeda. You know, it's got decent snappy, you know, it's got a interesting plot. I just think they've just in this one expansion they kind of overtook how BioWare has been, not historical BioWare, but it's nice to have that, like, funny dialogue in between characters and you know, just have that kind of snappiness to it. So, but yeah, if you liked Guild Wars 2, it's really worth coming back to if you've ever been interested in it or like MMOs but you don't have the time for it. It's very easy. You can go do a couple missions and come back. So it's very, you know, pick up and play, and unless you're doing the raids, which obviously take 2 or 3 hours, but you can get a lot done like in a half hour, which is makes it quite nice.
Nice. And the Guild Wars 2, when you call it an expansion, you're not, you know, you get the base game, because I'm looking at it here. So, like, the base game, the standard is $30 US, and that includes Guild Wars 2, Path of Fire. Is Path of Fire the name of the latest?
Yes, Path of Fire is the latest expansion. Okay,
so you're basically, you when you buy the game, when the expansion comes out, are you paying for the expansion if you already own Guild Wars 2, or is it just rolled in?
No. So you are paying for that expansion, and I believe parts of the world are free to play now, and I haven't delved into that, but I've heard from some friends it's a pretty generous free to play, and I think you can maybe even play in the old world up to level 80 free. So it's you know, then if you wanted to go into the new areas for the expansion, then that's where the $30 comes in. So
gotcha. Yeah, because one of the parts of that is you get Guild Wars 2 Pathfire, and then you also get a max level boost, which gives you
right.
A character. You can boost a character right up to level 80 and get going. So that's $30. There's a deluxe one, which includes additional character slot, identity repair kit. You can change your look. Got it.
Yes, it's change your look presence. And your name. Yeah.
Got it. So, you know, just some, and that's the $54 US, and there's an $80 US, which gives you a lot of gems and stuff too. So they do the usual, the sort of hybrid MMO thing we're starting to see more and more now. And I mean, good for Guild Wars too. Guild Wars was forever. Like, Guild Wars just went on and on. They really broke the mold in a lot of ways. So Guild Wars 2, it's nice to see they're still supporting it and it's still growing.
And just one other plug, we have a pretty large community on the forums who play, and I don't think the guild is still alive. I think it's alive in name only, but the people on the forums can hook you up with some of the guilds that are still on the server and very active. And so I'm part of the Zealots of Shiverpeak, that I think they have quite a few of the Goodgers in that. So, nice. So there, you know, there's a large community of its playing. So
yeah, that's usually how it goes with MMOs on GWJ. We all form a guild, everybody's really excited, and then real life takes over and people start to fall off, and then everybody disperses into other guilds that are more active because you want to do raiding and stuff like that. Very good. I think that's all the games. Amanda, do you have anything else you want to cover?
I had one more that I wanted to mention, and I forgot about it until I was just kind of browsing the forums, and I remembered there was a game that I found. Somebody just made a flip comment on Twitter. It's not somebody I followed. It was just like I followed a series of chains of people's mentions and discovered this game called Crescent Loom. Now, I think he did the Kickstarter for it last year, and it's a game by, I think he goes by the name Wink, and he's a biologist who made a game that feels something like Spore meets like Kerbal Space Program, like as far as like you build these like microorganisms, you can add limbs, you can add fins, you can add muscles, and when you add muscles and what they connect to, it creates neurons in this little cell off to the side that's the brain of the creature, and you can go into the brain. right I can't believe I forgot about this. It was just one of these like random stumbles that I ran into and just found it, and it's super cool. But it actually takes real principles of biology and physics and inserts it in a game format, so you can actually wire this is above my education level, clearly. However, like you can map the different neural pathways with different transmitters so that they can do different things. So they can react to visual stimuli, they can react to bumping into walls, or they can just send out periodic regular impulses, which you can program by stitching the muscles together to certain parts of this, of whatever creature's body that you make. It's definitely educational. It's really difficult, but for people who really like to get into games with that really fine-tuned like finagling, it's really interesting, and you can, and I feel like it's still in their early development, but I mean, if you like Spore, if you like Kerbal, you should check it out. So it's Crescent Loom by Wink, I believe.
Nice. Yeah. And their tagline is create life, which pretty much sums it up. I mean, that that's a powerful thing. I love it. Yeah, that's Crescent Loom. They've got a looks like an itch.io page for it. You can check out. There's an online demo link here as well, and you can buy it for $19 US if you want to check that out. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That is all the games we've been playing. Let's go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Gamers with Hope. So just keep your recording going. If anybody needs to take a break, go to the bathroom or anything like that. This week is Gamers with Hope, and this is something that John pitched to us, as we've talked about before with the Patreon. When you give it a certain level for a year, we kind of say, hey, let's do a project. Like, what are you interested? What do you want to do? And John reached out and said, well, what I'd really like to do is do an article series about called Gamers with Hope, and about people talking about how games, the gaming community, how it's helped them. Something positive, right? Especially these days, there's been a lot of negativity, a lot of challenges in the gaming community with, with Gamergate and with all the kind of negativity and stuff that flies around. And so to bring some light to that. So I ended up writing a bit about my experience when I was in my late teens, I guess, actually at that point. It's right when Carl and I had met. Where I was in a fairly transitionary place in my life, and a pretty dark point too, of trying to figure out how to be an adult, to having just moved out of home and connecting with people online through video games, provided something that I wasn't that I was struggling with otherwise, just connection, community, people to talk to that in a way that felt safe about the stuff, problems I was having. And it really kind of saved my ass playing games like EverQuest and talking to people late at night and things like that. So I wrote a piece about that. Like I mentioned, Greg Decker wrote about how games really help him bridge the gap with one of his kids and stuff as well. So John, this was something that you had pitched to us, and we're still looking for more writers. I'm curious, what is it that brought this to mind for you? What is it about Gamers with Hope?
Okay, so actually, so when I first started donating at that level, I'd had an idea of like maybe doing like a historical gaming series, and you know that was months ago. And then you know last November happened, and it just felt like the world started to fall apart. And I there was another part going on with me too. I've been recently diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is. It's a situation where you either feel like you have crazy amounts of like manic energy and, you know, you're kind of like almost like an, like high speed all the time or like kind of crushing depression at times. And fortunately I've been getting treatment for that. So it's most days I'm pretty mellow, but you know, there are, it's got some difficulty. So I started thinking to myself, well, maybe this is something other people have experienced too. Not necessarily bipolar, obviously, but you know, other challenges in their life. And I know that Gamers with Jobs has become kind of a safe space for me to talk about some of these things, and it's just an amazing community. So I kind of wanted to open up and to continue to donate so we could, you know, create that series. Mm-hmm. And you know, my thought is just kind of open it up if you wanted to write about how games are helping you with, you know, major issues in your life, if they're helping you, you know, get it, you know, in contact with, or not contact, that's not the right word I'm looking for, but to, you know, to something you do with your family to kind of help build like, you know, Decker's, you know, beautiful article about autism and how gaming has kind of opened up bridges there. You know, certainly if you felt you wanted to talk about, you know, anything, you know, race, sex, gender, be happy to whatever people felt like comfortable with. It was just the idea of like, I wanted something that was A, positive, and B, also not, I mean, on top of the negative, there's also the flippant, if that makes sense. Like my son can watch, you know, hours and hours of like crazy Cuphead videos, which is great. I mean, there's a place for that, or like, you know, Minecraft, or you know, like crazy videos. I just want something that, you know, if people wanted to talk something more serious, that, you know, that give them the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, so we encourage everybody to submit if they'd like to submit writing, or if they even want to pitch an idea before they sit down and actually write a whole piece. I'll put links in the show notes to the article that launched this series, how to get in contact with us. And if you're, we help with editing, we give feedback. If you're a writer and you want to try and get something together for a platform and have an audience, we're happy to help you through that process as well. So I'll put all that information in the show notes. But I wanted to ask Amanda and Carla as well, and as far as Gamers with Hope and the way that we can use video games, or the way that this community can provide support and can be a pick me up or can be something that helps us through tough times. Have you had any kind of experiences like that that would lend itself to it?
I've mentioned it on the show before. Like I have anxiety and depression, which are, and I say this, I'm not trying to say this to be flip, some of the lighter issues that folks can deal with. And I just mean lighter as in they're more prevalent. They're not as, there's still some taboo, but they're becoming easier to talk about and easier to say, this is a thing that I have that a lot of people have, and we all deal with it in different ways. So I feel like it's easier for me to talk about that, games in that context. Mm-hmm. But writing about it can be hard. I've started so many little articles, and a few things I found out, my writing skills have deteriorated, so I need to practice that. But also it's, how do you approach something that's so personal and so raw and then share that with a bunch of people? Like, that can be intimidating. But if you feel that urge, if you feel that kind of need to say something, write something down, I still do it anyway. Like, it's surprising how often somebody will share something and the number of people that come out and say, like, thank you for saying this. I've been feeling the same thing. I've been hearing the same things. I'm glad you were able to put it to words to make me feel less alone. So if you're inspired to write something, even if it can come from a place that is traditionally considered dark or intimidating or difficult to talk about, there are angles to approach it. Like, I know that for me, multiplayer games, online games, places where I have something that forces me to get out of bed and connect and be somewhere where there are other people, like, that's achievable for me. Going out in public and making friends out in the real world, at that stage, probably not so much. So I find it's a really valuable stepping stone, and being able to communicate that and talk about it and write about it, I'll hopefully be able to get to that point someday and do that. But yeah, like, I encourage everybody to explore some kind of creative element to express sort of what you're feeling and how games could help you do that as well.
Yeah, and probably worth noting too that we're open to publishing things anonymously as well. So if there's something you want to write but you don't feel comfortable putting your name on it, we're open to that too. Certainly nobody needs to. If you have a lot you want to say, but for maybe work reasons or privacy reasons or something, you don't want to have your name on there, we can navigate that with you. We're pretty discreet for something like that when we need to be. And it's cool what you said, Amanda, because it immediately brought to mind being in a situation where people count on you, right? Being in a situation like in a guild situation, where you're part of a raid, or Carla, like when you were playing EverQuest back in the day, you're part of a guild that actually used to put together quests, because in EverQuest there wasn't actually a lot of quests per se. Yeah. And you were actually part of a guild that would actually make up quests. So players would actually go, and players would act as NPCs and give clues and things like that. And there'd be like actually quest rewards and everything. Having people rely on you, especially if you're dealing with depression or when you're feeling really homebound and inward, that can be like a really great way to get a leg up, something to re-engage you with the world in that way.
It can, but it can't. Don't put yourself in a position where you feel like everybody's counting on you and you failed them if you can't make it out of bed that day.
Very like, important.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a balance. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Like don't overextend yourself because you feel like you have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, and also just writing length. Like, it could be a poem. It could be a short paragraph sharing an experience. Like, you don't have to write, you know, several dozen paragraphs or multi-pages to feel like you've got considerable content. Sometimes less is more, and it can be more impactful that way too.
Sure. Carla, what about you? Is there anything to this for yourself personally?
Totally. It's interesting you mentioned the EverQuest days, because when I was actually dealing with my depression, I often went inward into games, like single player games, to get kind of relief from what was going on in my head. It was an escape more than an engagement, I would say. And I don't know if that was hopeful for me as much as it was just a staying action. But that can serve as its purpose as well, I think. I think games, especially these days, have the power, in as much as any other kind of media, like books or movies, to move us. There's games that I've played or that I've played with you that I found really hopeful. The Last Guardian, I found that was a beautiful, moving, emotional experience that spoke about hope, like just the content of that game, the story that they told, and the fact that it was about a bond, and it was about the power of love and friendship and relying on each other. I really loved having that experience of that game. And I may cry a bit talking about this, but that's okay. You can talk and cry at the same time. It's one of the things that I feel very strongly about, that it's okay to cry sometimes. While my dad was very ill, and in the hospital towards the end of his life, I replayed the game Journey. And I don't know if people listening will know too much about that game. It garnered a lot of critical acclaim, but I don't know if it like did very well financially speaking. It's a gorgeous game. And it deals with themes of death and rebirth and learning from the past and moving on towards the future. And the end of it is a very explicit metaphor for dying. To me, it was, anyway. And that gave me a lot of hope, I would say, in that particular time, which was really obviously a difficult time for me, but also one where I was kind of grappling with, well, a lot of different things at that point. And the idea that a game could so beautifully illustrate a metaphor for rebirth and for new and beautiful things coming out of a lot of pain and suffering was really important to me at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, you played it a lot. I remember you actually, because I think at some point your character that you control in Journey, like you can be like a white scarf or something, right? Like there's like a pinnacle, and you end up, the more you play the game, you're meeting the one of the beautiful things about Journey was that it would actually put you into contact with other players' games. There's no real way to communicate verbally or anything like that. There's some really minor communication tools with gestures, and you can basically sing at each other, right? Like kind of pulse at each other. And so you'd play this game, which is a really beautiful experience, and then you can play it again and help other people through theirs. And there's something, frankly, kind of healing about doing that and having that connection in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was kind of a beautiful thing that they built into the game, this metaphor of rebirth and this metaphor of learning and moving on and passing on that knowledge to other people who come after you. And there's a, as you were saying, there's like a visual sort of change to your character depending on how many times you'd replayed the game and how many of the game's secrets you had unlocked. Your robe becomes more and more ornate until eventually it turns white. And so if you were a newer player and you were matched up, like randomly, as the game does, with a player who has more stripes on their robe than you, or a player whose robe is white, you knew that you could rely on this person to show you secrets and help you through the game and kind of make your path a little easier.
Yeah. And I think that just sums it up so well. We're going to leave it there. So I really encourage you, if you are a budding writer or a long-standing writer, if you have your own story, your own Gamers with Hope story that you want to share, you can hit the show notes here. Like I said, I'll drop a link so you'll have different ways to reach out and contact us, and we'll get you going through the process. And get you on the front page of gamerswithjobs.com. So, John, thanks for bringing this up and giving us that push. And I think we're going to get some really nice stuff out of this.
Oh, well, thank you guys for all you've done. And, if you don't mind, I'd like to say, you know, part of the beauty of Gamers with Jobs is I've had my own also personal journey. There's certain things that that probably I was more smug about and I shouldn't have been. And I've had a chance to meet people on different, you know, hot button topics that just, you know, hearing from their side of the story. And, I'm hoping to add to that. At least, you know, I can talk a little bit on the mental health side of things. I really appreciate this, the community, and you know, this is one of my ways I was hoping to get back. So thank you again for all you guys do. So,
well, thank you very much. Well, there you go. Let's go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, your emails. Emails, and I've actually got two emails here I'm going to read because they're both somewhat related. So I'll read them both and we'll tackle them. Hello, GWJ. This one, first one is from James, also known as Mr. Bossman in the UK. Hello, GWJ Eitz, longtime listener, first time emailer. What do you think about the recent trend of microtransactions being put into full-priced single-player games like Shadow of War? Isn't the developer of Hellblade showing the publishers how things should be done? Do you think publishers are the old way of doing things and we need to leave them behind? Regards, Mr. Bossman. And before we get to that, let me just read this next one from Matt from Iowa, who writes, I'm sorry, I admit it. I spent $20 on randomized loot boxes on Shadow of War. I really like the game, and I have the money, but not the time. Please tell me I'm part of the solution to keep AAA releases at $60 and not part of the game industry's money-grubbing demise, Matt. This is all coming up recently. These loot box discussions coming up, running alongside EA has announced that they've shelved the current Amy Hennig-led Star Wars game. They've closed Visceral, who was actually working on it, and they've said they're moving it to a different studio within EA, and they're refocusing, I think, is the corporate speak. On that, so there's been a lot of questions about loot boxes, the viability of single-player games. Are more games can be developed towards supporting loot boxes to increase income for publishers and things like that, to try and keep up with the ballooning software development costs of making these big games. And actually, I was talking to David Heron about this, one of our developer friends who's been on the show before, and he pointed out that the math isn't quite, like, when you're looking at the Star Wars game closing, the math isn't quite the same as, say, an Uncharted, because with the Star Wars game, EA has to look at the development cost, marketing, publishing, all the usual stuff, plus a pretty big chunk of their income goes to LucasArts, right? Because they have to pay licensing fees too. So instead of maybe making $30 per game, maybe they're only making $15. So that changes the whole arithmetic they need to work through when they're trying to figure out if something's viable. But nonetheless, so full price single player games, getting loot boxes now, basically other opportunities to spend more money. We've seen that in pre-orders. You can get the Ultimate Edition, which includes the bippity boppity boo, like whatever weird stuff they're throwing in these days, and action figures and everything. John, I'm curious, from your perspective, I don't know actually what kind of gamer you are per se. Where do you land on loot boxes in single player games?
Well, what's funny, right, is earlier we talked about the $80 super deluxe edition of Path of Fire, and I totally bought that. And
one
part
of
that
gems.
That's the thing, is that the nice thing about Guild Wars 2 is you can sell gems for currency, similar to, I think, World of Warcraft does that now, but you have a lot of control over it, so you can sell like 100 gems at a time and get like 10 gold, you know. So if you want just one little thing, you can spin that off some. And for me, the fact going into a new expansion, I needed new gear, what I had was fine, but if you want to do a new spec for your character, then you need, you know, a completely different gear set. So for me, the amount of time spent farming wasn't worth it, and I was happy to, you know, kind of give them that extra money just so I can jump right in and I can play what I want to play. And I think some of it too is I'll do that more for a publisher I really like. Like I have several friends who work at ArenaNet. I've met them at different functions. They're great people. So to me, I'm happy to support them. If it was, I don't know, I'm trying to think. Who makes Shadow of War? Is that EA or Ubisoft?
That'd be Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers. Okay, but you know, if it's a developer that I don't really love, but I like maybe one thing of it, I'm going to be a lot less willing to pay for that, you know, the extra.
Another way to frame that might be a personal stake, right?
Exactly.
And that is actually a big part of what this is and what franchises are trying to build out. You know, arguably Destiny 2 and Destiny, players have a huge personal stake in these games. They have a really big buy-in, and so part of that personal stake means they're willing to put in extra money. Same with like League of Legends, getting new skins for characters that you really like to play as. That's a really easy buy because you're really bought in already. You feel personal about it. It's not just it's not just like a mercenary kind of thing. Sorry, go ahead.
Is there something to be said then about what kind of things that the publishers are trying to sell you? Like, are they trying to sell you things like the loot boxes, which kind of replace game time spent, you know, like you can pay instead of playing the game for a while, or a new skin, which is perfect, more like fashion for your character rather than something that affects gameplay or something that affects the mechanics of the game?
I think the heart of it is just a question of developers and publishers. Because honestly, my sense is that developers are not really inclined in this direction. I think the fear on the player side of things is because of the existence, because they want to sell you extra stuff, are they withholding cool stuff because they want to sell it to you later? If one of their members of the team, say, makes a really cool piece of horse armor, are they going to then say, you know, that's the best one, we're going to put that over here, where players either need to grind forever or they can just give us some money and get it, right? And these are kind of the questions that seems to be the underlying fear with all this, is that game design is being compromised because of the existence of this stuff. Because, like,
how
I would say,
just monetize. Like, it's still there. It's like there's still the idea you can still get it if you just grind out for it.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm probably pretty unpopular in this opinion, but I don't mind microtransactions for things that are cosmetic or just, like, it's when it's in a single player arena, you're no longer worrying about people paying to be better in a multiplayer setting. They're not buying advantage in any way, so this is primarily just for your own personal fulfillment. If that's the case, that's a personal choice. I find it's we're kind of subscribing to the idea that the systems never change, and that this is a direction that games are going that is unprecedented. But like, it development always works that way. It's all this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. So things. The methods with which we get the different parts of our games are going to change. And everybody's been talking recently about how games are getting more and more and more expensive. Like, that cost is going to have to come from somewhere. It's either going to be a $100 game or microtransactions. The person that busted out that really awesome horse armor, who's paying for it? Like, how, like, that's a lot of skill going to something specific that should be funded.
I am really truly of two minds. It's something I should probably really sit down and meditate on and write about or something, because I really do feel it from all angles. When I look at Shadow of War, which is the latest example, I haven't felt any inclination to buy loot boxes. In fact, I have in-game currency that I've earned just playing the game. I could actually spend on loot boxes, and I don't want to. Because I don't want to just have something handed to me. I want to earn it, damn it. I'm going to go out there and convert those orcs. I'm going to put in the time. Yeah, I want them to be my orcs. I don't want to be sitting on my dark throne and have a present show up in front of me and an orc pops out. Like, I didn't earn that. That doesn't feel like my army anymore. It just feels weird, right?
Yeah.
The game has, like, ultimately, boil it down. The game has to be good. If it's not good, you're not going to spend extra money on it. And if you feel like you have to spend extra money on it in order for it to be good, it's done. Like, gamers are sensitive, man. Like, it's done if you do that. So I think it's also helped, quite frankly, taking a wider view rather than looking at a particular game. There are more games than I can keep up with at this point. It's bananas. Like, Amoebic or Amanda just talked about this game where you create life that looks really fascinating and amazing. I've never heard of it before, and it's been out of there since January. Like, it's crazy how much stuff there is to play. Single player, multiplayer, co-op. There's so many different kind of games you can be getting into. This AAA tentpole thing used to be such a centerpiece of the industry. It used to be the whole thing. And every once in a while, you'd have like a little indie game here and there. And now it's almost the complete opposite. There's hundreds of indie games, so many different things for so many different tastes. There's Dream Daddies, and there's all this kind of games. Like, Stardew Valley.
You keep bringing this game up.
Because it blows my mind how popular it is, right? There's all these amazing games that you can be playing. And then every once in a while, we get like a AAA tentpole that is trying to not just take up 20 hours of your life, but 200. And they have a different objective. They have a different metric for success. They have different needs. You know, EA has a lot of middle management they need to pay for. That bloat ain't going to pay for itself, you know, like, and they made a lot of money on things like Mass Effect 3, multiplayer cards and all that kind of stuff. So, if you're playing and you feel good earning that stuff, and every once in a while you feel good chipping in $5, and you feel good, you're having a good time, you're getting value out of that, that's really what it comes down to. And if the game sucks and if they've compromised it because they're trying to force you to spend money, then it's going to fail. Like, it just, that's just how this stuff seems to go. That's how I feel about it. Sorry, I got real hot about that one.
Yeah, you did. I was impassioned.
Next email, please. Get me out of here.
All right, our next email comes from our guy, J.R. Rawls. He asks, the amount of times it takes to learn to game, a game greatly varies, but in general, do you enjoy the act of learning how to play a game, or is it something you push through in order to have fun?
I hate learning. My least favorite part of a new game is the first, like, half hour to 45 minutes where I have to fucking make the dude swing his sword or figure out how the inventory works or all that kind of shit. Ugh! Help me! Just make a short, concise tutorial and make it easy to do, and I don't want to, like, spend half the game learning how to do shit, which is probably why I never play strategy games or anything like that, because the learning curve is just either too steep or too long, and I just cannot with it. I cannot.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat with Carla now. Like, the older I get, the less time I have for everything.
Yes,
and the less
yes.
time patience I have for stuff that takes way too long for me to learn. So if you've got a steep learning curve and there's a lot of information to learn, you better parcel that out over time so that my old brain is like can just compute it. Like, give me the chance to be able to, like, slowly digest this in a way mm-hmm. that is, like, I can set at my own pace and I'll be happy. Like, if it's too much too quick and then suddenly you don't know what you're doing with the game and you've been playing for an hour and you're still in the tutorial, like, no thank you. Yeah.
Push to the stick to the right to move the camera. Ugh. Good job, soldier. You know, we've had so many things.
Build it into the game, for God's sake. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that Zelda Breath of the Wild doesn't teach you enough, but you know how to climb stuff, you know how to swing a sword. They ease you in, and then they let you go, baby bird, and grow and figure it all out. Like I mentioned, like Total War, Warhammer 2, there's a good amount of systems in play. There's a lot of interface there, but they do a good job of, like, you start the campaign and they just take you through it. Okay, you're going to need to do this thing first. You're going to need to do that thing first. And it's sneaky because you're like, okay, I'm just following the tracks. Oh, here's the first battle they want me to fight. They're going to teach me how to do the battle. This has to be an easy to win battle. They sneak up on you because you do that battle. You go and take a town as they lead you to do it. And then all of a sudden, you're like, okay, I think I got this. And you turn around and the guy training you is gone and you're in the middle of the forest. And they're like, okay, good luck. Those elves are coming here now and those guys are coming. And you've just made that decision, which totally throws this whole thing off the rails. Off you go. Like, that's a pretty good tutorial, but I arguably few and far between tutorials are still pretty tough. What do you think, John?
So to me, it's two parts. So one is learning the basics of a game, right? And I agree with you that Warhammer Total War does it perfectly well, having played a lot of them in the past, where some of the early ones were, unless you were a big strategy fan, you just were not going to get very far into it. But there's also the other side of it is learning how to play multiplayer, which is completely different, you know, when you go on your first dungeon or raid or when you go into your first PvP battle, then suddenly it's like, oh, well, you know, they told me in the tutorial I'm supposed to use this. There's like, you know, only noobs use that, you know, you're totally supposed to do this completely other different thing that's counterintuitive, but that's the new meta. So to me, I kind of like learning new systems, and I think some of that's because my day job is a tech writer, so I have to, you know, learn how to do instructional things. And so for me, it's a little bit of trying to figure out how other people do it. But then in multiplayer, I completely hate that because then you just feel like the idiot that, you know, should have figured this out in the tutorial. But it, you know, like I said, a lot of times it's counterintuitive. They tell you to do one thing, but the community is all have all hacked the system so that, you know, this is actually the most optimal route to go do things. So I kind of hate multiplayer learning, if that makes sense. So.
Completely, because that is like a trial by fire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And no one cuts you slack on it either. That's the other hard part, you know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Carla, you've got our next email.
Okay, so this comes to us from Mateus. Hi, people. I'm a new father, and with my wife and I being passionate gamers, and Ocarina of Time being a game with a very special meaning to our relationship, we decided to name our daughter after Zelda. We spell the name Zelda, though, with an S, which in German sounds exactly like Zelda, but we don't like the look of that Z there too much, and also Zelda's a fairly common Turkish name, which is probably the largest foreign cultural influence here in Berlin, so we get to tick that hipster checkbox and claim that extra integration effort. nice going, guys. All that being said, we're continuing our name list for the next one. Congratulations. And we're particularly interested in nerdy, gamey names. It seems non-female names come harder to us, so here's the challenge. Can you come up with 7 video game character names that you would name a, not necessarily your, baby boy? The only rule, no generic names, meaning Max, as in Max Payne, is not a suitable name. Cheers, Mateus. Okay.
So, no pressure. No pressure.
Yeah, you've hamstrung us here, Mateus, I have to say. because any male character video, and I went looking, I did some research on this. Any male character game or name from a game that isn't something like Nathan or whatever is going to be like Kratos or Diamond Dave or something like that. And
Kratos,
I don't know that you want to saddle
name.
Your kid with that.
Kratos
like,
is a strong name, though.
Which? Kratos?
Yeah, sure. You know, he throws a tantrum. You're not going to feel bad. It's like, well, it's Kratos. He's got anger problems. What are you going to do?
That's quite the legacy to give your bouncing baby boy. With yes. that in mind, I mean, there's Alistair from Dragon Age, which is an actual name that is, like, you know, not generic, as you were saying.
Maybe just don't let him play Dragon Age 2. Maybe don't.
Points, yeah.
Maybe just don't let him play the game. Maybe.
Or, you know, Herschel from Professor Layton.
Herschel?
Or Layton. Layton's a boy's name.
Yeah, just Layton.
Sure. And that was actually on my list. So,
okay, very good. Go. What else you got?
I was going to say Cullen from Dragon Age. I don't think it's it's not like a very, you know, well-known name, but it has that kind of, you know, kind of hipstery, like, you know, 2017 right now. But, yeah. You know, it has that millennial feel to it that it's not too out there. So
I wonder if we're far enough away from the Twilight series for Cullen to be redeemed.
Ooh.
Oh, is that a Twilight thing?
Ooh.
Yeah, Cullen was the vampire last name in those books.
Yeah, maybe give it a few years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wasn't even thinking of that.
Thane from Mass Effect 2.
Mm-hmm.
Thane mm-hmm. Krios, the assassin. Cool guy, Thane. Cool voice. Yeah, yeah. So Thane was a good one. Layton was the other one. And Axton from Borderlands 2.
Ah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure. That's good. I have to say Geralt. I mean, it even sounds—it even has a certain Germanic sort of vibe to it. I think that's pretty good. Matt wrote it down.
I actually crossed it off my list because I figured you would put that.
Yeah, no.
She was relying on you, Sean.
Yeah, and certainly we have a close friend who named her boy Locke, which is like from Final Fantasy. That is a great name. It's an amazing name. You know, you're not going to meet a lot of Locks out there, which I like a lot. But yeah, like male names are tricky. There's a lot of Sams and Steves and stuff out there when it comes to video games. Like Nathan Drake, you know, Sam Fisher. Like it's just,
it comes
Bob the Builder.
There's a lot of white guy protagonists out there in the video game world, and they all seem to hang their hat on Max or something similar.
Yeah, well, have you considered just naming your child Agent 47?
Hmm.
You know, or
Master Chief.
Or Master Chief is fine, or just like Chief. Or no, see, that's
no,
kind of weird.
No, don't
no,
do
maybe
that.
Not. Maybe not. Ezio.
Commander.
Commander.
Say, welcome, Commander. Yeah. You have done well. Or, you know, they get their first F is like, you have disappointed us.
Yeah,
no, that's funny because like somebody has to go change the commander. It's your turn to take care of the commander. So like,
commander, you don't even give him a name. You call. You always say the before you
the
say
commander.
Anything.
Yeah.
Like, but it's hard because you're not going to call your kid Conker. You know, like you're not going to call your kid like like
Bowser.
Bowser.
Solid
That's
snake.
A good dog name, though. It's a pretty good dog name. Or Astaroth. You know, like there's a lot of ways you could go. You don't want to call your kid Glass Joe. That's just going to lead to problems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that makes a motherfucking statement, though. There's not going to be two Glass Joes in kindergarten.
True. Although Guile's not bad. Like, when you look at his Street Fighter names, Guile's not bad. It's not bad. Amanda. all right. So that's our emails for this week. call@gamerswithjobs. You want to send us an email. Amanda, I think it's important here that you read our thread of the week here. If you want to go to gamerswithjobs.com/forums, you can get into all these really important conversations, video games, politics, life, all kinds of stuff. But we get into the really important stuff. Amanda, this thread is actually one that you made. Please tell me all about it.
It is called "What is the best donut?" Minotaur thinks it's Boston cream. He's wrong. It is strawberry jelly filled donut from Tim Hortons. Please discuss.
Oh my god. Okay. First of all, baseline. I'm a Canadian. I'm in Winnipeg. I'm very Canadian. Tim Hortons does not belong in this conversation.
No, Tim Hortons is baseline.
Okay, I posted further in the thread that just because it's trash and it's bad doesn't mean that sometimes you want something because it's bad.
It's just bad. Available. Like, I think there's something to be said for it's available. That's the best I could say about it. Well, I walk into a Tim Hortons and my tummy feels bad.
Okay, these things taste like the toaster strudels I used to have as a child. So, like, it's just this nostalgia kick, just, like, biting into one of those. So that's why I love it.
Okay.
It's not, like, the best out there, but it's the best in my heart.
Fair enough. I did contribute to this thread. The sour cream glazed donut is an underappreciated donut. It's basically just a basic donut, like a vanilla kind of donut, but it has sour cream in there, so it's a bit denser and it's crispier and stuff. Like, that's a good donut. It sneaks up on you.
There's all kinds of opinions here, and I did want to highlight a post from a new poster. C.P. Wilson, who spent the time and effort to make a donut chart that is so incredible, compiling all the information that he gathered from the thread into this, like, well-rendered thing that it's so beautiful. Oh my God, he made it in Excel.
It's glorious.
He made a donut chart. I love what he wrote, too. So this is C.P. Wilson. He's a coffee grinder, meaning he's a new poster. This thread has drawn him out of lurking into actually participating. He's from Edinburgh in Scotland, and he says, "Look, it's Friday night. I'm waiting for my fiance to come back from work. Now, this isn't me trying to save face for having scraped this thread into Excel to count/graph which donut is best. It's an excuse for why I can't spend more time making this proper infographic. I wanted to make a donut map. Oh, well." So he mentions that GWJ likes plain/mild flavored donuts with coffee. A donut should be seen, not heard, when in the company of good coffee. Krispy Kremes did not fare well. If you're going for a cider donut, it better be, quote, from an apple orchard in the fall.
Damn straight.
So there's some strong opinions here, but I will say that a plain glazed donut so far, at this point in the thread, this is from Friday, that has 14 votes.
So boring.
And like, just to be fair, I posted at this at 3 in the morning my time. Context. Secondly, it is a... compiled a great list of local donut shops from around the United States and the world. So if you're a donut aficionado, you should just check out his post because he's got it all in one place. It's really good.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is obviously this is a very hot button sensitive topic.
Yeah.
So I'm a moderator. I keep a close eye on it. We're 5 pages deep already. It's a pretty new thread. And Maylor, in fact, points out, "Welcome, C.P. Wilson. That might be the single best post from a coffee grinder that I've ever seen." You know, so bravo.
Well done.
And that's what we like to see. So if you're out there, you're awesome, you like donuts or whatever, and you're thinking like, forums, I don't need to be part of no forums. You really do need to be part of at least one forum, and it should be the Gamers with the Jobs forums, because we do everything in there, and it's a good time. So that's going to do it for this week. Once again, John, thanks very much for joining us here. And thanks again for providing the impetus for Gamers with Hope. We're going to put up links in the show notes so you can see where you can submit writing or pitches, or reach out to us if you want to do some writing for the front page of gamerswithjobs.com. And you're certainly welcome to do so. And that's going to do it for this week, folks. On behalf of Carl Andrich, Amanda Knowlton, John DeWeese, also known as JD Zappa in the forums. Production by Jonathan Downen. I'm Sean Andrich. We'll see you next week.